Hello and welcome to Radio EduTalk. My name is David Noble and I'm in Dalgety Bay in Scotland. And for today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Tom Middlehurst, who's the Head of Research at the SSAT. Welcome to EduTalk, Tom.
Good evening, David. Nice to speak. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. And we're looking at curriculum design in today's show. And this is a pre-recorded show, but if you've got any comments or questions that you'd like to be passed on to Tom, then you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, just pop something up with the hashtag edutalk, edutalk, and indeed Tom himself is on Twitter, it's tom_middlehurst. So just to start off with, Tom, could you give us a bit of background to your professional career and also the work of SSAT?
Yeah, absolutely. So SSAT is an independent network of state-maintained and state-funded schools, mainly operating in England, but operating elsewhere in the UK and internationally as well. And for over 25 years, SSAT, under various different guises, has supported schools to network and collaborate with each other. And very much at the heart of what we do is a commitment to schools working together to share the best practice about what race outcomes for young people, but also, you know, the most innovative and exciting new practice that they are experimenting with and finding out what works. In addition to that, we provide access to theory and to the world of academia that can be then translated into school practice as well, and that's very much at the heart of what SSAT does. My particular role there started with student leadership, and we were looking very much at how students can become active participants in education and can co-construct their learning experiences with staff. About a year and a half ago, I then became head of research, as I said, sort of working with academics and with universities to look at how they can work with schools in innovative and interesting ways. And this work around curriculum design came from that.
That's fantastic. And
So you go, Tom.
Sorry.
Yeah. We worked with a lot of schools around curriculum for many years, but obviously in the last 18 months, and particularly in England, there have been huge changes to the curriculum. And the advice very strongly from government is that schools should be free to design their own school curriculum. Obviously, in England, we have a particular context in which over 50% of secondary schools are academies and don't have to follow the national curriculum as such. But despite that, the strong message from government is that the curriculum itself should be designed by schools. And so we work with Professor Dylan William, who many people will know from his work on assessment for learning, to look at some principles that might underpin how a school would go about designing a curriculum. And so over the last year, a lot of our work has been around this concept of principal curriculum design, where schools themselves design a curriculum that meets the needs of their own students.
And I came across your presentation earlier on in 2014 on this particular subject, Tom, and that's what we're going to be hearing from you about in a moment, principal curriculum design. But this is also part of an ongoing extensive CPD programme. So just before you kind of start your input, Tom, can you just put it in the context of the support that SSAT provide to teachers across certain schools in England and Wales?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, we provide support in all sorts of areas. I mean, curriculum and assessment is just one of those. And our motto that then used to be our official motto was by schools for schools, and it is about that sharing of good and innovative practice. But I'll come on now to look specifically at the issue of principal curriculum design, if that's okay, David?
Yeah, that would be great, Tom. Thanks.
Brilliant. So what I'm going to say is very much based on the work we've done with Professor Dylan William, but hopefully I'll be able to illustrate it with some examples of what schools are doing around England and internationally and in the rest of the UK based on Dylan's work around this. So Dylan very much starts from a premise of why we bother educating young people in the first place. And perhaps as educators, it's not a question that we ask very often. You know, we turn up and we do our jobs and we might have gotten into teaching for various different reasons, but very seldom do we actually sit down with colleagues and just return to that very simple fact of why bother educating. And if we look back to Williams in the 1960s, he identified four broad views on the philosophy of education, on why we educate. And the first of those is an idea of transmission of knowledge and culture, a sort of Matthew Arnold idea of passing on the best that has been known and said in the world, which, you know, I think is very important. But then when you look to the work of the OECD and to others who talk about education as preparation for work, and we know that when we have a skilled workforce, they are more productive, and clearly it has economic importance for countries to educate young people. Then you can look at the work of Paulo Freire, amongst others, who talk about a personal empowerment, about making young people able to take control of their lives and be active individuals. And then kind of coming on from that, you can look at the idea of preparation for citizenship and taking part in a democracy or a society. You know, and the work of the Council of Europe has explored that in a lot of depth. So those four very broad reasons, transmission of culture, preparation for work, personal empowerment, and preparation for citizenship, to me are the four cornerstones of why we educate. As I said, at SSAT, we do a lot of work internationally, and we've been doing some work with China recently, and it's interesting to note, I think, that the four pillars of Chinese curriculum, as specified by the government, are learning to know, learning to do, learning to work together, and learning to be, which speak very closely, I think, to William's four broad principles of philosophies of education. So once you have that clear in your mind, sort of what is it as a school that we are trying to do here, I think that's the basis of any conversation about curriculum. And when we work with schools, we often say to them, what is the reason why you educate? Is it to pass on knowledge, or is it to get people ready for work? And is that the view you articulate to the students and the young people in your schools? Because actually, I know that as a former teacher, it's very easy to focus on just one of those, whether it's about the next stage of their careers and the importance of getting, you know, five good qualifications or getting to a particular university. But actually, if that's not our core purpose, how can we articulate that in a way that's going to make sense to young people? And so from there, I would say that's really the basis of any curriculum design. And just to put it in some context, certainly in England, before 1988, there wasn't a national curriculum as such, and it wasn't until the Education Reform Act in 88, when Lord Baker brought in a national curriculum, that schools had that to work from. And Dylan William would argue that act of having a national curriculum actually de-skilled a lot of teachers as curriculum designers. And Dylan William was on the expert panel that suggested the revisions to the national curriculum in England. And the panel's view was that the national curriculum should only form about 50% of the school curriculum. And again, I think it's interesting, if you look at the Scottish Curriculum for Excellence, again, it's phrased from a series of outcomes and experiences, but how schools realise that, it is, I understand, very much up to them. And Dylan says that there are three broad understandings of what a curriculum is. And Dylan would argue that a lot of people see the white papers that governments send, whether it's the National Curriculum in England or the Curriculum for Excellence, as the curriculum. And Dillon would argue, actually, that is the intended curriculum. Then you have the implemented curriculum, which is when a school takes those policies and puts them into context. So it's about the textbooks they buy to realise it. It's about the schemes of work they write around those policies. But then you have the real curriculum, which is the received curriculum. And that, in his words, is the lived daily experience of young people in the classroom. Because regardless of what's written in the intended curriculum or how the implemented curriculum is structured, actually what children receive on a daily basis is their curriculum. So if we take an example of negative numbers, the intended curriculum, the government policy, might set a particular age range in a child's education when they should study negative numbers. Then in the implemented curriculum, you would look at, okay, which term we're going to teach this in and who's going to teach it and what textbooks we're going to use. But then when it gets down to the classroom level, how an individual teacher chooses to deliver that material, to deliver that curriculum, so are they going to explain the concept of negative numbers through sea levels or through temperature, that is the experience that young people get. And that is the real curriculum, the lived daily experience of young people. And that observation allows Dillon to say that pedagogy trumps curriculum every time. And I think that's a really important statement. Pedagogy trumps curriculum every time, because we talk a lot about the curriculum changes and we talk a lot about implementing government curriculum policy, but actually it is what we do in the classroom, our pedagogical techniques, that trump that every single time, because that is the experience that young people are going to get. So I think as a starting point, it's really useful to bear that in mind, that regardless of what government policy says, whichever state you're in, you do have different types of curriculum. And how we perceive that will influence how much control we feel we have over designing the curriculums right for young people. If we look at the history of curriculum, it's quite an evolving context. And the term curriculum actually appears to have first been used in Scotland in universities in the late 17th century. And it just meant the courses that students are studying. And that seems to be the earliest use of that word curriculum. And then Tyler, in 1949, asked four questions which he identified as a curriculum. And it was essentially, what educational purposes should we be seeking to attain? What experiences will help us to attain those purposes? How can those experiences be organized, staffing, timing? And then how will we know when they've been attained? How can we assess that they've happened? And I think those four questions are still really useful in terms of defining what a curriculum might be now. And then Dennis Lawton in 1975 said that the school curriculum, in the wider sense, is essentially a selection from the culture of a society. And I think there are two important messages there. One, that it is a selection. It can't be everything. You've got to narrow it down in some way. And secondly, that somebody is making that selection. And that, crucially, is what I think we've got to at the moment, in terms of curriculum design, is it's about who is making that selection from society. In the same year as Dennis Lawton, Lawrence Stenhouse identified the role of curriculum designer as being with the teacher, because he framed a curriculum as a proposal, as a research proposal, as an idea, as something you're testing out. And obviously, if you're testing it out in an absolute pure situation, in a pure circumstance, then it's always going to work out for you. But as we all know, classrooms are not pure. They're messy places, and you've got perhaps 30 individuals who all have very different needs, and the fire bell might go off, and they are not pure environments. And so that experiment is never going to work out properly. And what Stenhouse said is that if teachers have not been there to design the curriculum, and they're just implementing curriculum they've been given from above, And when things go wrong, they won't know how to correct them because they don't understand those four broad questions about what they're trying to attain and how they're going to get there. And what Stenhouse said is that teachers become intellectual navvies, digging holes and not ever questioning or knowing why. And so it was Stenhouse back in the mid-70s who really identified the need for teachers to be curriculum designers and to be the heart of curriculum design. And as I said, Dean and William would say that in England, since the adoption of the Education Act in 1988, that's a skill that has been lost, but we now have an opportunity to regain. So from that, and through our work with Dylan, Dylan suggests seven principles of a good curriculum, which I'm going to talk about in order now, and then reflect on actually what that would mean for a school to put into practice. So Dylan William argues that a good curriculum has to be balanced, it has to be rigorous, it has to be coherent, it has to be vertically integrated, it has to be appropriate, focused, and it has to be relevant. So the first of those is that a curriculum has to be balanced, and certainly both the National Curriculum in England and the Curriculum for Excellence in Scotland talk about a broad and balanced curriculum. And the reason for this, as Dylan says, is because we are the first generation of educators who know we have no idea what we're doing. And, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric about, going into the unknown world and about the fact we don't know the type of world that we're preparing our students for. And that's very true. But actually, we're at an advantage because we're aware of that. And I think we are far more aware that we don't know what the world's going to be like than teachers perhaps 60, 70 years ago who really couldn't have imagined the changes. I think that we can imagine the changes, but we are aware that we can't. So the only way that we can future-proof our students for that is by giving them a very broad and balanced curriculum. And when you look at the type of subjects that are most curriculums across the world and in the UK, you have a mixture of very traditional subjects, English, maths, sciences, one of our languages and the humanities, but there are some interesting alternatives that you see creeping in. Stuff such as chess, for example, can be really useful in the school curriculum in terms of mind training, and there's all sorts of interesting alternative subjects that we can use to give that broad and balanced curriculum that's going to future-proof our students. But those traditional subjects are traditional for a reason, which brings me on to Dylan's second principle, which is that a curriculum is rigorous. And those traditional subjects are still relevant and still on the curriculum because they are rigorous and they are important disciplines in their own right. Subjects such as English and maths and the sciences have important disciplinary habits of mind that help young people make sense of the world around them. And I think that's really, really crucial. So on a cold day, when we walk outside, we feel as though the cold is getting into us and making us cold. Obviously, a physicist would say, no, that's not what's happening there. Actually, it's the heat leaving your body. So physics is a very deeply unnatural way of looking at the world. That, that goes against what it feels like to us. But actually, training young people to think as a physicist is an important disciplinary skill. And I think that in a good curriculum, we do have to have that disciplinary rigor that help young people think like mathematicians or like physicists or like biologists. My own personal view is that certainly in secondary schools, we don't do enough around English to explore those strong disciplinary skills. And I would advocate that actually schools timetable English language and English literature as separate subjects. My own background is as an English teacher. And I think that for a lot of young people, being able to think, right, now I'm in my literature lesson, I'm really looking for you to be excellent readers and critics, as opposed to now in the language lesson, I'm really looking for your use of language and you as writers, would really help that strong disciplinary rigor. So having rigor is clearly important. However, we can move on to Skinner's third principle, which is that a curriculum is coherent. So we may have strong disciplinary rigor, but how can we make sure that all of those disciplines work together to support cohesion across the curriculum? In other words, how can we make sure that the totality of the students' experiences reinforce one another? If we take some very easy examples, you're likely, as a student, to talk graphs both in science and in maths. So who in school is making sure that the maths department are teaching graphs at the same time as they're needed by the science department to do equations? And you might think it doesn't matter, but actually, if the science department teach it in a slightly different way, then that's going to present difficulties for some students later on. So I think having that coherence and someone in school that has that oversight of, well, when are we doing this in different subjects and why, is really, really strong. Obviously, a good way of achieving that coherence is through interdisciplinary projects. And the project has come and gone in education, and it receives various criticism. But I think a good project is a very important way that students can exercise those disciplinary skills in a real-world setting. And I think a prerequisite for any good project is that it is real and authentic. And there are lots of interesting work being done in schools who are doing projects maybe on a weekly basis, instead of drop-down Friday, or on a termly basis, just having the day when you do just work on a project rather than in disciplinary lessons. And it does, as educators, challenge us to think about how we teach as well. Having one group of students for 5 hours is very, very different to having them for 50 minutes, perhaps. And we have to think quite radically about how we're going to deliver that. And so I do think the project has a place to play within curriculum design, but it does have to be handled very carefully. So a curriculum could be good in that it is balanced, it's rigorous to the subjects that are within it, and it's coherent in that the totality of experiences reinforce one another. But it could still be lacking if it doesn't promote progression, which is Dylan's fourth principle, that a good curriculum is vertically integrated. In other words, that it does promote progression over time. And Dylan gives the example of teaching the areas of various shapes, and he suggests the areas of shapes such as parallelograms, rectangles, squares, trapeziums, and triangles. Now, in most schools in the UK, young people will learn the area of a rectangle before they learn the area. So they'll learn the area of a square before they learn the area of a rectangle in most UK schools, which, is fine. However, in Japan, where they look at this stuff in a lot of detail through lesson study, they've realized that actually the best way to teach young people the areas of shapes is to teach a rectangle first. Because in a square, it's just a special sort of rectangle, and you don't have to do any more teaching there. It's already done. So thinking very carefully about how we arrange material in the curriculum is important. Again, I think it's a really key point to note that in the National Curriculum in England, written into the Education Act in 1988, it says that the Secretary of State for Education cannot tell any school the order in which material has to be taught within any key stage and the length of time that any topic has to be studied. So all the Secretary of State can do in England is to define what broad content has to be studied over a key stage. How that's arranged is entirely up to the school. So this idea of a vertical integration and progression over time is crucial. And there are different ways that you can structure content. Some of them are optional. So, for example, in history, do we study the Romans before the Vikings because it's chronological, or do we deal with topics in an increasingly more sophisticated way and we look for material throughout history that allows us to explore those in increasing depth? Then you have ones that feel quite natural, that it makes more sense to do multiplication before division. Or does it? Again, there's some very interesting studies done around working with primary school children, and asking them to construct stories around multiplication and division. Interestingly, they find it much, much easier to construct stories around division. So they'll say something like, John had 12 sweets and he had four friends, so each friend got three sweets. But when you ask them to construct stories about multiplication, they find it much, much harder. And they say stuff like, well, John had four sweets and Sally had three, and they times them together via 12. So even ways of structuring material that feel quite natural to us, actually we can rethink when we're designing a curriculum. And that is why teachers have to be there, because teachers have are uniquely placed with the knowledge both of the subject and of pedagogy, how young people learn. So teachers are the best people to make those judgments about the arrangement of content and material in schools. And a lot of schools had the idea of a spiral curriculum, which it has been popular since the 1960s when Jerome Bruner came up with the term. Dylan would perhaps argue that what we see in lots of schools is not so much a spiral curriculum, but a circular curriculum, when we end up just repeating material. So a true spiral curriculum obviously builds on itself and deals with particular topics and skills in an increasingly sophisticated and complex way. And to return to what Jerome Bruner said about the spiral curriculum, he said, we might ask if the criterion for any subject taught in school, whether, when fully developed, it is worth an adult's knowing, and whether having known it as a child makes a person a better adult. If the answer to both questions is negative or ambiguous, then the matter is cluttering the curriculum. And that is how high Bruner places the stakes in whether something should be in your curriculum. If it's not going to make that child a better adult in later life, it has no place in Bruner's spiral curriculum. So that's it. That's putting the bar really, really high. And I think as teachers and schools, it's up to you to decide how high you place that bar, what is going to be your selection criteria for any content in the curriculum. And that comes into this idea of progression. So building on from that, clearly what we're talking about here in a spiral curriculum is being focused, which is the next of Dylan's principle. And you know, we all know how little time we have in school. So the idea of being very, very focused is incredibly important. And we, you know, we've known this for a long time, as early as 1941, Richard Livingstone, who was the president of Corpus Christi College in Oxford, said that too many students leave school, the appetite killed, and the mind loaded with undigested lumps of information. The good schoolmaster is known by the number of valuable topics which he declines to teach. And I think that is a fantastic quote. The good schoolmaster is known by the number of valuable topics he declines to teach. If we love our subjects, and our subjects are great, then there is going to be fantastic stuff that we would love to teach that we can't, because curriculum time is precious and valuable. So you have to leave some of the good stuff out for the even better stuff. And how you make that decision will be very, very idiosyncratic. And that, again, is really important, I think. And one way that you can practically achieve some focus within a particular subject curriculum is to come up with the 10 big ideas. And this comes from work with Wynne Harlan and others who are scientists in America, and they worked with schools in America and in the UK to come up with the 10 big ideas of science. So, for example, the first of the big ideas is that all material in the universe is made of very small particles. For this group of scientists, that is a big idea, that if young people leave school knowing they will be better people for it. And it is a key fundamental idea of the curriculum. And what we would suggest is that as a starting point for subject curriculum design is that with colleagues, you sit down and you identify what are the 10 big ideas in your subject. And there is no right or wrong answer. You know, Harlan's 10 big ideas of science is one approach, but there will be others. And so I think it's saying, what are the underlying principles, these underlying ideas that make our subject what it is? And then, when you're arranging the material, when you're making that selection from society, as Dennis Lawton puts it, it gives you a framework to work in. And I think that's a very useful, practical approach to using curriculum time parsimoniously and being very focused with it. So the next principle that Dylan suggests is that our curriculums are appropriate. And he points to the Leverholm report, which was done with primary schools around the UK. And it was looking at whether children between the age of about 6.5 and 11.5 could do a simple sum of 485 plus 214. That was the report. And what they discovered is that at age 6.5, around 15% of students could do it. At age 11.5, around 90% could. In other words, over 5 years, the increase in facility was around 75%, an average of 15% every year. So this tells us two things. In a class of 30, only 4 or 5 children are learning this every year. But the fact that 4 or 5 are probably means they're being taught it every year. And when we look at Western education systems, the UK and America and North America, what we see is we tend to do material in far longer lengths of time than in some Asian cultures, where they will actually just do it later in the school career, but do it at a point where most students will understand it and then move on. So you don't have to return to it year on year. And you know, again, as educators, I think we will recognize that we do certain topics seemingly again and again every single year. Actually, if we're doing that, why not just do it a bit later? So do it at 14 rather than 11, when we think students might get a better grip of it in the first place. So having an appropriate curriculum, which is obviously linked very, very closely to the idea of vertical integration, is key. We can also make sure that our curriculum is relevant, which is the last of Dylan's principles. And I think this comes down to the idea of informed choice. In other words, we give young people informed choice about what they learn, the curriculum, and about how they learn it, pedagogy. And obviously, the amount of choice we give tends to increase as young people get older. And so when they make options for the qualifications they want to take, they'll have a degree of choice, and that will become increasingly larger degree of choice as they get older. But I think we can make our curricula relevant at all stages, and even very young children express very sophisticated ideas about how they learn best, and we'll be sitting up to capitalise on that. Again, this comes back to the idea that pedagogy trumps curriculum. We can make any implemented curriculum relevant through the way that we teach it. I think when we're thinking about what we want out of a school curriculum, it's useful to frame it in terms of outcomes and experiences, which is very much what Understand the Curriculum for Excellence does. And particularly, except in England, we've been very outcome-driven, that everything we do in our curriculum has to produce an output. It has to do something. What I really like about the Scottish Curriculum for Excellence, and I don't know it very well, but just having a look through it, is that there are a range of outcomes and experiences. So if you look at the Scottish Curriculum for Excellence's section on dance, I should point out that the Scottish Curriculum is the only curriculum in the world that has dance as a separate subject, as distinct from PE or performing arts. And what the Curriculum for Excellence in Dance says is that young people should experience just the joy of dancing. And I think that's really beautiful, actually, that an expression of what we want out of the curriculum is just to do something for the sake of doing it. And it might not have a tangible outcome, but it's an experience that we want young people to have. And I think in terms of a relevant curriculum, that's key. Sometimes what our curriculum is going to have is not going to produce a particular piece of work or a particular skill, but we're just allowing people into that world for a moment and to have that experience. And I think that's really important when we're designing school curriculums. Interesting to note, Dylan William would argue that because of his definition of a curriculum being the lived daily experience of young people, he would argue there's no such thing as extracurricular activity. Because if as a school you're planning it and it's an experience that you're giving young people, it's part of your school curriculum. It's not extra to the curriculum, it's part of it, a fundamental part. So if we are thinking about the outcomes and experiences we want our young people to have, those enrichment activities they do, sports, drama, music, are all part of that. And I think that's a really refreshing look at what it means to have a curriculum. So they are Dylan's seven principles: balanced, rigorous, coherent, perfectly integrated, appropriate, focused, and relevant. And what a school will do with them, I would suggest, is first of all to look at them, say, are these the right principles for us? Are there any that are missing? And then talk about what does that mean for us as a school? How does our curriculum work from that? And then from there, you can map the content on and go down into subjects. But that starting point is to agree those principles. And at SFAT, we would argue that that's not done in isolation, but done in conversation with other schools, with all members of staff, not just teachers, with the students themselves, and with the community and other stakeholders. And I think when you achieve that agreement around what your principles are, that's a really strong foundation to then put content onto it, which might be directed from government, or it might be local selection. But the point is that teachers are no longer the intellectual navvies. They know what they're doing, and they understand why. So that they are Dylan's approaches to principal curriculum design. Thank you.
Tom, thank you so much for your input for today's show. I'm conscious of the time. I've got several questions, and I'll maybe just pick out a couple in a moment. But thank you so much. I mean, you're talking across education systems, across very diverse parts of the world. You know, real interesting to hear you go back to the literature from 40, 50, 60 years ago. Firstly, No, sorry, on you go, Tom. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say, you know, if anyone does have any questions, and as you said, people can tweet, and I will answer those via Twitter, let's say.
Now, my understanding is that Dylan William actually produced a document for SSAT. Is that right? Was it part of the Redesigning Schooling series? And if so, is it available?
Yeah, that's right. There is a pamphlet that goes over a lot of what I said today, which is part of our Redesigning Schooling series. Redesigning Schooling is a campaign to look at what schools are doing to redesign schooling for the 21st century. And that pamphlet is available on the SFAT website. If you're a member of SFAT, it's actually available for free, but it is for purchase from any other school. Just go onto sfatuk.co.uk and follow the link through to the library, and you can find it there.
That's great. And I'm just wondering, Tom, have you got a couple of moments then just for a couple of moan questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if there's been any work done that you're aware of or ongoing research to kind of quantitatively measure the quality then or the impact of a curriculum. You know, we're talking about across the English system or aspects of the English systems and the Curriculum for Excellence in Scotland, this focus on outcomes, and we talked about, you know, kind of levers, destinations as well, and the whole idea of outcomes being beyond just examination passes. So, you know, I'm just wondering if there's anything out there. How do your schools measure the impact of their curriculum? I'm thinking, you know, coherence is so important, you know, according to what you've said today and according to William, but how do you measure something like coherence?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, for us, that is really, really crucial. And in terms of sort of looking at the impact of that, it is notoriously difficult. And actually, one of the reasons that it is so difficult to actually measure any kind of impact of any education intervention is going back to the start of what I said about those four broad philosophical reasons for education. And because people have different ideas about what education is for, it's very, very hard to say that one thing works and another doesn't. So one person, for example, might say, well, you know, we can show that through this particular approach, all of our students go on to university and to achieve great jobs. Whereas someone else might say, well, that's not the test of a good education. The test of a good education is the amount of knowledge and skills that young people have. And so I think it is notoriously difficult to measure impact in that way. I think for me, around that kind of those outcomes and experiences, it's our moral duty, I think, to young people to give them a range of that, a range of opportunities. And I hate the idea that we have young people leaving schools who have sort of existed in the sort of virtual world and they come out without having really done anything. And certainly, employers are telling us that young people might have great GCSEs or great qualifications and you know, even great degrees, but they haven't actually done anything, and they don't have those kind of wider skills they're looking for. So I mean, one approach that I really like is the idea of a student passport, which is very, very popular in lots of schools. And just to give an example, I mean, Passmore's Academy in Essex has a very successful passports. Passmore's was the school in Educating Essex. And it's just a series of outcomes that young people have to do over their 5 years or 7 years at Passmore's. And it's a really nice articulation of that. But in terms of the impact, I mean, it is notoriously difficult. So slight fudge that question, David.
And this kind of Stenhousean idea or at the heart of his work in years gone by, teachers at the heart of curriculum design. And I'm just wondering if you can say a bit more about how that is being ensured now within various aspects of the English system. It's very interesting for me because that, along with a lot of what William has said, and obviously he's been very influential in the changes in Scottish education, it's almost as if that most of us in the UK are now singing from the same hymn sheet, and yet, you know, in Scotland, I would always have the sense that we regard each other's systems as vastly different, or even in opposition in terms of their kind of basis. So, going back to what Stenhouse, you know, has said previously, it just seems to be something that we're all, most of us, if not all of us, are trying to do currently.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, Dave, the line sort of cut out there, so I didn't quite hear all of your question. I mean, I think it was along the lines of sort of what schools are doing around that. I'll talk about that very briefly in hope that's what you're asking, but it did cut out, sorry. There's some wonderful work going on all around the UK in terms of school students into practice, and certainly on Twitter there's some great practitioners who are doing this both from the school level and from a classroom level. And just to pick out a couple, we have a research group at SAT called Vision 2040, and there are some practitioners on that who are looking at this in a lot of detail. So people like Stephen Tierney, who's at Leading Learner from St Mary's College in Blackpool, have a very principled approach to their curriculum design, both in terms of kind of what studies, but also the options and the arrangement of exam, exam courses. Then you've got senior leaders, people like Alex Quigley at Huntingdon School in York, who are designing curriculum based around kind of threshold concepts and looking at ways of assessing a curriculum that actually measures key skills in subjects. And then you've got sort of people like Saffron and Gill, who are working on what a principled approach to curriculum might look like if taken up wholeheartedly by the system over the next sort of 25 years or so, so kind of going beyond five-year policy cycles. So I said, I'm not entirely clear what you asked, so I couldn't hear all of it, but hopefully that's
no. Helpful. That's great, Tom. But the main point I was trying to get across is that from the work of Stenhouse and the influence that he continues to have, and the work of many UK educators, and the clear influence that Williams had on the design of the curriculum for excellence, it seems that we're not that far apart in terms of the various English systems and the Scottish system, the way that we go about designing our curriculum. And yet, in many policy spheres, it would be suggested that Scotland and England are vastly different in the way that we go about designing our curricula, as well as various pedagogies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I confess, I haven't been to many Scottish schools recently, but I would imagine that there is far more difference between schools in each of those systems than between the systems themselves. So, I would imagine there are schools, in the southwest of England who, are very similar in terms of their approach and their pedagogies to, schools in the Highlands of Scotland, but that actually the school down the road from them might be really quite radically different. And certainly speaking, in England here, obviously with the increasing role of academies, there are huge differences in what schools look like, and certainly in terms of curriculum design as well. So, I should point out that this does come under our redesigning schooling campaign, and therefore we would see as quite an innovative practice, and schools that are engaged in this in a really sort of meaningful way are leading the way in this. And there will be a lot of schools who, rightly or wrongly, will just implement the national curriculum as they receive it. One might argue that that's an absolutely legitimate response to government policy. And it's the right thing to do for young people. So I'm not quite sure where I would stand on that particular issue of quite how different the systems are, but my sort of gut feeling would be that there would be more variance within the systems themselves than actually between them.
Yeah.
But that'd be something I'd be interested to hear your listeners' response to.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a couple of quick questions to finish up, Tom. With the schools that you work with, are there any moves towards kind of suggesting or even making it so that teachers are responsible for, or all teachers are responsible for, certain aspects of the curriculum? So, for example, in Scotland, with Curriculum for Excellence, as you'll be aware, there are aspects of literacy, numeracy, and health and well-being which are under the umbrella of responsibility for all. And I suppose we don't just mean classroom teachers there, but as you've alluded to, the curriculum is really the totality of all experiences now, so it goes into the community as well. So any moves at all towards it being suggested that those who work with young people in your schools are actually all responsible for those three areas, or indeed other areas, other headings within the curriculum?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is definitely a rising tide, going in that direction, just to mix my metaphor slightly. But absolutely, I think that is a key movement. And there's some really interesting work being done around that idea. So there are some schools that I know of who have this sort of Wednesday afternoon idea where sixth formers, the oldest students in the school, will actually take the lead on a particular curriculum enrichment area, And that might be around chess, or it might be around sports, or it could be around music. And they will lead the younger years in those activities, in part of that curriculum or extracurriculum, depending on your view of that, allowing teachers time to do research and to take part in research. So I think there's some really interesting models. Looking at Tom Sherrington, again, another big person on Twitter, and certainly at his last school, when the ICT curriculum in England was still in place, it's obviously now being replaced by computing, but he realised that actually the ICT curriculum wasn't working. It was too dumbed down to the students that he had in his school. You know, they were looking at stuff like how to use Excel spreadsheets and how to use Word, and these kids knew that. Clearly, they did. They'd been doing that for years and years. So what Tom did is he asked the Year 9s what they wanted to learn in their ICT curriculum. They articulated what they wanted out of the curriculum. Then they went to the sixth form, realising that the sixth form had actually probably greater technical computing skills than some members of staff. And they said, who has these different skills as identified by the Year 9s? People put themselves forward. Together, they collaboratively planned a curriculum for the Year 9 ICT lessons, and then sixth form was delivered it. So I think, you know, a really excellent example of how not just staff, but students can co-construct curricula in really meaningful ways that everyone buys into. So absolutely, it's definitely a movement in that direction.
Well, that's a fantastic example to finish on, Tom. Thank you so much. It's been an excellent hour to spend in your company as a practicing classroom teacher. Just about to go back at the start of the new term. I've found listening to you absolutely fascinating, and I'll certainly be taking some of the principles that you've spoken about and some of the work of William into practice in the next few days as I get set up for the new term. So on a personal level, thank you very much. And as you mentioned, you know, there may be some comments from listeners, and we'll make sure that we pass them on to you, or they'll pop up on Twitter at some point in the coming days. So thanks again, Tom, and best wishes for the future.